Hi, this is Mark again, back in the office the day after the second day of the conference, just reflecting back on what happened on the second day and compiling a set of interviews with people that I recorded yesterday. We kick off with Mia, who was the closing keynote on the first day, but is the first person I spoke to yesterday. So, over to you yesterday, Mark. This is the first podcast recording of day two, and I've got Mia, who will be the keynote rounding off the whole conference at the end of the day. So, Mia, do you want to tell us a little who you are, where you're from, a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Mia Ridge. I'm a digital curator at the British Library. I've been there almost 10 years now, which is vaguely terrifying. And my job there is about getting people to use the library's digitized or digital collections, but working very closely with curatorial colleagues. And I think it's kind of interesting being here the last half day or so and thinking about how that relates to digital learning and the ways that people are using technology and the ways that people are thinking about what technology means for how learning is changing, how the university experience is changing, because that sort of flows through to what people want from a library, whether it's a university library or a national library like the British Library.
Because that's a really interesting discipline at the moment, particularly because digitization is taking off so much. It's transforming archaeological research, history. both of us didn't get to sleep until about one last night. So being able to not pronounce history properly is... So anyway, I'm trying to say historical or history, but historical research and all those sorts of things. I was at the Ushaw Library, which was open for the first time to the public since it began, which is last month. And they're talking about digitizing stuff there and about how people are now accessing things they could never access before. So is that... That's my take from the outside of the discipline. How accurate is that as a take?
So if you're a library that mostly has contemporary material, a lot of that is available digitally. But the issue for us is that maybe 10% of our collections at this point have been digitized. We have up to 200 million collection items. So scale for us is really different.
Wow.
About half our material is unique as well. So even if most material that's been published has been digitized, there's still a lot of material in various libraries and archives and museums that hasn't been digitized. So one of the challenges is letting people know that the total sum of human knowledge is not yet available online. It's not available in your AI chatbot. There's still a lot of material, a lot of viewpoints, languages, perspectives that aren't represented in what's been digitized. And because of the scale of the undigitized material, it's still a long way from being in a state where everything can be digitized, as well as considerations like copyright. We're a legal deposit library. We're very respectful of authors' and creators' rights, so we don't digitize material that might be to the detraction of the creators, because we know there's a lot of anxiety in the publishing industry about that. But people's sense of like what goes into the sort of the large language models and whatever is... It's really not very complete. So one of the things that we're doing is publishing things like data papers that helps explain what's in digital collections, the factors that affect how searchable they are, so when they were digitized. Things digitized 20 years ago are less searchable because the optical character recognition is in poor quality. So really kind of like basic digital literacy, but search literacy, and I guess now large language model literacy in terms of what's included, what's not included. And the many and various reasons why things might not be included. But then the other side is doing a lot of work with teaching digital methods to staff and to others in the library and the GLAM sector, so galleries, libraries, archives and museums, so that we're more collectively ready to meet the challenges of people coming in with new questions. And that's what's exciting, that we are developing new methods for thinking about analysing collections and looking for patterns and consolidating what we know through traditional research combined with computational research methods. So trying to take advantage of the opportunities by preparing the ground in terms of literacy and a broad understanding of what's digitized, what's digital, and how new methods relate to those materials.
Oh, that's really cool. Sorry, I just, the laugh halfway through was GLAM. It's like, yeah. Oh, that's such a good acronym. I immediately went to thinking of SLADE.
Well, but, it's a very Australian acronym, and I think my theory is that Australians, the whole ABBA, Priscilla Queen of the Desert, like we've got a bit of a thing for sequins and satin.
Yeah.
So GLAM made more sense than the American LAM or the British MLA.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. So, sorry, I completely... But no, that's fascinating. Is that what you're going to be talking about this afternoon?
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to create an opportunity to think about the joy in using collections and the joy in connecting with people and collaborating. And that joy can be really hard to find because we're all going through really challenging times. The Bandford workshop, I think there was a lot of tired nodding in recognition of restructures and polycrisis and this sense of like we haven't had a chance to really process the COVID pandemic and everything else that's come since then, and we're all kind of like just struggling on. So having a moment to think about the joy of learning, the joy of creating experiences for other people to learn and to kind of share some of the, looking back over the kinds of threads that have run through my career in different institutions in terms of like making collections open, but learning how to do it better so that they're actually more accessible by thinking about things like scaffolding and the design around open collections to make them more accessible.
And I guess I'm going to maybe sort of go into a bit philosophical here and existential, but I guess you have a longer term, you know, more of a deep time perspective on these things because you're working with stuff which, I mean, what's the oldest thing that you're working with in digitising?
In the British Library, the oldest thing is 3,000 years old. So okay. Not that old in the grand scheme of things.
But in written stuff, it's getting towards the
part. Yeah, it's Chinese oracle bones. So they're kind of marked up so that you can throw them into, in a way it's generative AI. Like you throw the bones, they have markings on them, and then the work actually happens in your head. To interpret them and to make sense of them and say, yes, I see how this translates to my life.
Yeah, because some theories about the I Ching initially was that it was, I'm talking to the people who know more about this, and I just happen to have read about it recently, is that it was originally oracle bones, although there's not necessarily any evidence of that. So, yeah, throwing the bones, I have a set of D20, D10 dice that are in the shape of bones. So just how I can tap into that history of bone throwing.
Yeah, there's nothing the Chinese really new stones. Under the sun. And I think that's the perspective that I bring is I've been in the sector over 20 years now, which is terrifying, and in a lot of different contexts and countries. And, Gen AI has definitely created a big tears and a lot of fuss, but it's not that new in itself. And for every technology, there's what the technology itself means, and then there's how society responds to it and how it restructures finances, how it restructures work, how it restructures where we live, how we live. And so one of my big messages is that we still have agency in this time and we can make decisions about how we implement things like generative AI, how we look at machine learning more generally, and that we can demand better architectures. We can demand architectures that are better at being truthful, which is really a concern for libraries and other institutions. The potential of machine learning and AI is amazing, but if it can't be accurate, then it's really very limited use. I mean, it can improve findability by expanding keywords and giving like generalized descriptions of things, but we need accuracy, we need precision. And in general, everyone's going to ride along in the hype, and I think the hype wave is already kind of crashing. But libraries are really used to dealing with changing technologies. We've been doing it for a really long time and changing how we work with people in society as well. So I think a big message is that change is constant. It's hard to go through, but we can look at how we've dealt with changes in the past and hold tight to the values that we think are important. We don't throw those values out just because there's a new technology come along.
Excellent. Yeah. So... How are you finding the conference? Are you enjoying it? What's the key takeaway so far?
I think actually getting back to being playful again in conferences. Conferences sort of had a long time of like just getting by and that stretch when everyone is trying to do hybrid. But there was a time when, and I guess that social media exposure moment when things could be taken out of context and we're all a bit more grown up now than we were. So it's nice getting back to being in a space where people are thinking about being playful, about being cheeky. I've heard the term mischief a number of times, and I love that. That's a whole different energy that we can reclaim and bring back because, you know, polycrisis is here to stay in some ways because we've got really big challenges coming up. So maybe if we can reclaim that space for being human, for being allowed to make mistakes, for being fallible, and for having fun and being playful together.
Yeah.
So it's been nice for those reminders.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, look forward to the keynote.
Thank you.
So thanks, Mia. Right, okay. Oh, we're off. So the second recording of the day. And I've got Philip Anderson, who's from Northumbria. He's a local boy.
Yes.
And so, Philip, do you want to tell us who you are, a little bit about yourself? And,
Yeah. Thank you very much. So my name is Philip Anderson. I've been an academic at Northumbria University for 24 years. Got into it, really, certainly higher education academia, got into it by accident. I was always interested in either teaching or police. Roll forward a few years, working in IT support, chance conversation with another academic, why don't you give it a go? Gave it a go, and shall we say from 2001, the rest is history. And then more recently, to bring the policing career aspect into it, I now teach police officers around digital evidence, digital crime scene, digital evidence management and things like that. And I've been doing that with Northumbria Police and Durham Constabulary for the past 7 years.
Okay, and that's what you're presenting about here.
So, yes, so...
You're the VR guy.
Well, it's interesting. I have a partner in crime called
you're allowed to call them that, considering your job.
Because of the policing context. Well, put it this way, without him, I wouldn't have been able to bring what we have done to life, so to speak. So, again, from Northumbria University, have a colleague called Craig Clark, who's a technology enhanced learning analyst. Mm-hmm. He's done a lot of work with VR and nursing. And the workshop, my workshop presentation came about because of a need. It was to solve a problem in that when I'm teaching the police officers around crime scene searches and digital evidence, when we first began the journey with the police students, it was a nice cohort of 24. And that was nice and easy. We could get them in, they could get hands-on, they could do things in the real world. And then two cohorts later, I was informed there's 75 students coming. Oh, yeah. So that presented numerous challenges, the biggest one around logistics, in that you could spend half a day getting 20-odd students through in groups of three or four. It would take an entire day. It's not just how you manage those in the crime scene, it's what the others are doing that aren't in the crime scene either. So I was introduced to Craig by a colleague who teaches nursing, Claire Ford, and basically this is what we use VR for within nursing. So again, conversation with Craig, and he was like, yeah, we can do that. So from that, we've got the students would wear the VR headsets. It's morphed numerous times, and there's been tweaks and changes and things. And we're in a position now where we've almost got a library of different scenarios. So from that initial, right, we want students to search a house virtually. And again, the learning element is still strong because it's what we're doing it for. We're trying to enhance the learning. Where they'll search different rooms, they'll identify different digital devices such as mobile phones, such as GoPro cameras, sat-navs, SIM cards, SD cards, PlayStations. In this day and age, digital data and digital devices are just numerous. And then within the virtual environment, they will go around and search for different rooms, they will click on the devices. So I feel we're very much at the beginning. We've got the basic concept right. We're very much at the beginning and where we want to move it on. Craig, we were looking to be able to employ a student intern recently for 12 weeks, I think it was. And we've moved that restrictive VR environment with the sticks. And we've been able to create elements where they can pick objects up and they can examine them, they can move them around and they can drop them into evidence bags. it's a really beta version at the minute, but that's ultimately where we want to be. Now we're at a stage now where we're getting requests from the police trainers.
Right, okay.
So we've, and again, so the, what I was explaining in the workshop this morning, each scenario has got a different learning element to it. It's got a different outcome as well. So the crime scene search is very much immersive. It's about the student in the room doing what they've been taught to do. So they've had the theory input, right, go away, new practice. We've done examples of domestic violence where the student is almost an observer over the shoulder. And the four police trainers involved are acting out the scenario. And it's this fake blood. There's, you can imagine it's as realistic as possible. From the policing perspective, the realism is what they want to get their students used to as well. Because obviously when they get out there and they do the real job, it's going to be quite quickly. There's going to be some realistic scenarios. And again, it's not to desensitize them to them, but it's to let them know. Prepare them. It can be at this level. On Monday, we're going back with me and Craig, going back to Northumbria Police, and we're going to do again an almost over-the-shoulder one where somebody's locked up and taken into custody. So watch the whole process all the way through so students can watch it and understand it. So that's the theory within the VR environment. So now you've got 70 students.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take 70 students to a custody suite. You can't have, how do you run it if you run it in pairs? And it's just, this solves a lot of the problems around logistics. And again, it's just getting that learning environment right. And potentially, it's basically, we just sit now. We would like more money to do more. That's a different conversation. But now we're at the request of the police trainer saying, can we do this in the VR environment?
Yeah.
So we've got in the pipeline, we've got potentially giving evidence in a court because we can't physically get 70 students into a court and experience it. So again, this is a theory, right? Let's go and watch this. Let's go and interact with it. And again, what we've learned over doing these different scenarios is how you embed. So do you have pause buttons? Do you pop questions? There's so much learning from an academic perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So much learning you can put in there. Do you have hotspots that brings up other video links? Brings up URLs? Do you have prompt questions? What do you do next? But again, what we've learned from the different scenarios, that doesn't work the same. You can't have the same approach for the scenarios because they're very different. So going back to the crime scene search, potentially you could have prompts and questions around, right, you've identified a mobile phone, what is the right way to seize this in such like, whereas the domestic violence one, it's very much the observational and the recall skills. So there's no need to put any other elements in there other than sit back and watch what's going on in front of you, and then you go back to the classroom and recall it.
So when you were doing this physically with, like, the crime scene stuff, I'm guessing you didn't actually take him to a crime scene. Can you imagine that scene in Vera where she goes, there was going to be some evidence, Philip came in with his students and he screwed up everything.
I don't have the same problem as Vera, albeit she's very local. So we're fortunate as a university, we have a dedicated crime scene house.
Oh, okay.
So we have other programs.
It was built like that. It didn't just end up being a house. That ended up being a crime scene.
It's a house on campus. So it's based at Coach Lane. It's a grade two listed, and it used to be staff offices. There's still staff in there.
Until the incident don't talk about.
I'll tell you a quick side story. Obviously the police go in and they teach them how to search, and there's different scenarios. So again, as realistic as possible. So there was an incident that the police, I can't remember what the exact incident was, but the training was basically getting the four students up outside, getting them all worked up to basically force an entry and arrest somebody. And two of the students went in, instead of turning left, they turned right and went through somebody's academic office shouting, it's the police, while they're on a Teams call. So that'll forever live in memory.
Oh, my God.
So we are quite fortunate where we have a physical building where we can do this. Again, it's shared with the forensic science students. So, interestingly, there's a blood splatter analysis room on the top floor.
Wow.
Which, and again, we have different scenarios for them. So, forensics crime scene preservation, and the police use it for various scenarios as well. And obviously, I've just come on and sprinkled SD cards and mobile phones and other various digital elements already over a well-established environment. So, we're very fortunate with that. But again, the problem became logistics, where trying to get 70 students in groups of four through that, and we're very restricted. So the police are all up for creating different scenarios. They've got them all scripted. So the one on Monday, I'm playing the arrested suspect.
Typecasting.
Yeah, so I get rolled up to the custody suite here. So I'm the one that I did point out, why am I always the villain and never the hero? So again, we're going to capture that. And again, that was prompted by one of the sergeants in the police training department saying, can we do this?
Yeah.
There's a lot of this, certainly from a law enforcement perspective. We haven't found a lot in the UK, but certainly in the US, it's building momentum and it's quite big. I mean, it's a slight extreme. But again, one of the problems we've got is, do people know what we're doing?
Mm.
And do I know the contacts within the police to turn around and say, this is what we're doing, would you be interested in us doing it? So, for example, if we talk about repetitive training, firearms training is a perfect example. Right. So there's potential we could explore that avenue. But again, from an academic perspective, I've got all these crazy ideas, no time to do them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sorry, between me and Craig, I'm the one that comes up with the crazy ideas and he's the one that makes them. He's the one that makes them work, yeah.
So what about the conference overall? Is there anything, how do you feel about it?
This is my first time at this conference and also this type of conference around educational learning. I've obviously Nick's witnessed, obviously Northumbria University now, moved from Durham. Mm. So again, I've spent time with her explaining what we've been doing and what we're interested in. And almost I wanted the opportunity to, not show off, but showcase my work. Yeah. But what I particularly wanted to do is, we've obviously run these VR environments with numerous students, I mean 500-600 students, and we always take feedback. What I haven't done is been able to get a body of experts or people who are knowledgeable in this particular area to provide me with feedback on that. So this is what we used. So the workshop I did was an hour and a half. It was almost a showcase stroke. Mm. Can we have your feedback and ideas? And right up to the end, one of the participants said, have you thought about this?
Yeah.
And I was like, no. But I really like your idea, so me and Craig. So we've captured that on a Microsoft form sheet. We're going to go through.
So you've got stuff to take back with you, which is always
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted was to get this in front of other academics, other experts in that field, and just rather than just the students that they're using it, because we get plenty of feedback on them. But interesting, what we find is one cohort will give this kind of feedback. And then another one, it's completely different. And then it's there's no consistency in the feedback with students, which is nothing new. But at least with experts, we've run it through and yeah. So we'll be taking stuff back and looking to change things. Yeah.
Oh, brilliant! That's excellent. Oh,
absolutely. No, I'm really really pleased I came. Really pleased. Cool. The day before I was starting to panic, but you know, now it's all over and done with. I'm really pleased.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. Right then, well, thanks, Philip.
Thank you very
much.
We'll
have to chat more about it because I'm really interested in VR as well.
Cool.
So,
definitely.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Right, thanks. I'll end it there then.
Thank you.
And for my next chat, I've got Philip's partner in crime, he described him as, but I'm not sure that's appropriate considering that they're working on a police project. But here we go. We've got Craig. So, Craig, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself and what your involvement is in the project? And
sure, yes. Yeah. So, my involvement with Northumbria is as a tel analyst, sort of specialise in VR and immersive content applications, things like that. Phil approached us a couple of years back with a logistical sort of like problem. Where we'd go to a crime house, the students would go around, look for different devices, logistically to get students around that.
I'm just going to pause you there and move this
around a bit. I was wondering
why we were getting dropout before. Let me just pause.
So, yeah, my name's Craig Clark. I work for Northumbria as a tel analyst. Specialising in a VR and immersive applications and things like that. Mostly work with the nursing cohort a lot. That's what I started with in terms of doing sort of VR for their airway assessments and breathing assessments. That logistically you can get a lot of people around a bed when they're doing this sort of like application as an assessment. Where you can get more people in the headsets themselves in a bigger room or watching it on a URL version of it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So my involvement here today at the conference with Phil, basically he approached us a few years back with a like a logistical problem as such. Basically, what we needed to do was create an application for students to use as a reference tool as well, to go around a crime scene house, finding different devices, logging them, creating notes with each other. As logistics was at the time, you couldn't really get 80 or 90 students within the couple hours to do that. It would take a full week, basically. So we came up with the idea of creating an immersive environment for them to, as again, reference tool as a URL or a headset in the headset application. And we could onboard them in that and get them around the application that they needed to do for the course within a couple of hours, all 60 of them as opposed to a week. So logistically, it worked really well. From that, we've created more applications from it.
So how does that match to the live thing? What kind of differences are there between what they're getting from the VR version and from the live version? Is it map exactly, or are there things that are missing out and extra things that they're getting?
It's map exactly. We also put some red herrings in there as well, kind of thing. Yeah. So it's basically, we're using it as a comparison at the moment between real world sort of like investigation, digital sort of like enhanced learning investigation, experiential. And we also, for future developments, we're trying to do another sort of Unreal Engine tool where they can physically pick things up and put them in an inventory next.
Okay.
So we're in development with that at the moment as well.
Because you're using Blender at the moment, are you?
Blender, 3D objects, creation. Yeah. There's a lot of tools out there now where in AI exactly, especially where you can say, create me this, and it would do it kind of thing. But we're trying to bespoke it with Northumbria and trying to create our own sort of digital assets and things like that, as opposed to using that as such yet. But
So they're reusable and across different sort of scenarios and things.
Absolutely, yeah. Drop in assets to the applications, different environments, kind of thing. So use it as template-based work, so we can change it for the different scripted scenarios that they use.
And so, what are you finding so far about the learning? Are you getting? Have you been doing it enough? Because Philip said it's beta tested. So, how's that testing going? Is it actually the students learning stuff from it?
Yes, they are. Yeah, there's a lot of really cool analytics that comes from it. We can embed sort of functional analytics from what they're doing with it.
Okay. So, like eye tracking and things like that.
Eye tracking's coming. Yes. Yeah, we're doing some eye tracking things like that. We've got some eye tracking accessories that we add to the headsets. And they physically just look at something and it would open, things like that.
So that's
what they're actually finding, and it's how they're finding the evidence, and it's good, it's going well.
Oh, that's excellent. And so what's next? Well, first of all, what have you got out of the conference? Has it gone? What sort of has it been?
It was great. Yeah, we got some really good feedback from some users, some delegates who came into the session. It was an hour and a half session that we did. We showed the repository of all of our applications that we have, that we can, in terms of accessibility, using them on website or in the headsets. We did some sort of feedback, sort of Microsoft forms for them to use, what they got out of the application, what worked, what didn't work, which is an important one when you're trying to retest and redo and sort of advance kind of thing.
Yeah.
So got a lot of really good feedback from that, in terms of both critical and sort of positive sort of.
Yeah. What's next then? Where are you going next with this?
So we had an intern last year, and my idea from it is to create a thing called a Gaussian splatter environment.
Okay.
I'm guessing you might know what that is.
Well, only from watching CSI and things.
Yeah. Okay. So basically what we can do is we can go into the manor house that we use as a crime scene.
Yeah.
Originally for the application we did, we captured them as panoramic images.
Okay.
Advancements in cameras.
Oh, sorry,
cameras.
I don't know what Gaz, because I thought it's something to do with blood spatter, but it is.
Yeah.
Oh, it is, okay.
Well, no, it's not. Basically, the panoramic images that we capture, our Gaussian splatter would capture would map the room, and it would just look much better detail and digitized using a LiDAR scanner.
Okay.
So that's the next step, where we can physically plop the students.
The LiDAR scanner in, yeah. And then just immediately convert that into like a 3D image. For the
stretch it out into the Unreal environment area, and the students can walk around it there and pick things up.
Oh, that works way better than like a 360 video, because because for a start, it depends on what your field of view is, in order which bits in focus and which bit isn't.
Yeah.
And then some bits seem bigger because they're close to the camera and they're smaller. Right. Yeah. Whereas this...
Yeah, you can walk right up to it and...
Yeah, and it still looks real even when you're going to... And you can move, because that's the other thing, is move... Going into proxemics is a huge thing with when you can move within a virtual environment, and video based VR, you can't do that because you've got a fixed image.
Yeah.
Whereas with this, you've actually got a 3D space.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, that's more like a virtual world.
So like
type environment
so like yeah. Yeah, like control haptics and grab functions.
Yeah.
So
you can
open drawers and things like that.
Oh my! Oh wow!
Type on a laptop.
Oh, really? And things come up? And can you see things on the laptop?
Yeah, you can embed sort of like assets, digital assets that you can put in 2D videos in there. You can put in...
Oh, wow. Okay.
If you get the template right, everything else can just drop in.
And what's the headset that you're using?
So we use a Vive Focus 3 headset, which is HTC.
Right.
Built for enterprise.
Sure.
Buy in bulk business.
Yeah.
We have 80 of those. I'm the only one who does the updates.
Okay, sorry. I get very excited here.
if I had to say before I started the job, basically the bought them before I started, I would have probably said buy 20, and then buy some digital assets and applications that we can use with the rest of the money. But as funding went, they bought the hardware.
Yeah, because you need that because that's
so we've got 80.
All right. Oh, wow.
But the in terms of headsets, are really future-proof.
Yeah,
in terms of
that's
updates.
The problem is changing them. Because
So these builds 2021, and we've still got a few years out of them.
Okay, that's excellent. So, yeah. Right, I'll end it there then. Okay, and I will be up the A1M a few times, I think, to have a look and see what's going on next, because this sounds really, really good. Excellent. Okay, excellent. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
And I have gone back to talking to people I know, because I'm now talking to Rochelle, who is somebody who's in my team at Durham, but I'm in her team. We're in the same team. That makes it sound like she works with me. It's definitely not that way around.
Nope.
And so, Rochelle, do you want to tell us who you are, what you do, and why you're at the conference?
Sure. I am Rochelle Rawlinson. I used to be Rochelle O'Brien and got married and made everything confusing. I work at Durham University as a learning designer, and I study at Northumbria. I do a
senior learning designer.
Oh, sorry, senior learning designer, because I am old. And I am doing a PhD at Northumbria University in computer science, where I'm exploring escape rooms, specifically digital escape rooms, and how they might be useful for education. And that's why I'm here. So I'm technically not working for Durham today.
Oh, you're here as a PhD student of Northumbria University.
I am, which means I have Northumbria on my badge, some people have spotted and some people haven't.
No, I hadn't spotted that.
Yeah, but it's a bit awkward because I do also work at Durham and lots of colleagues are here.
And you did your session this morning, am I correct?
Just before lunch,
So how did it go?
Spot. It went well, I think. I find it very strange presenting my research.
Okay, why is that?
Sorry,
this is turning into a therapy session now.
It is free therapy. Why is that? I don't really know. I'm confident with work stuff. I have to present and teach a lot, so I'm kind of confident with that. But when it's my research, it's my ideas, and I think because I am right in the middle of analysis as well. The paper that I wrote for this conference was a while ago now, and my thoughts have moved on, and it's revisiting where I was at then, where I'm at now, and it's not bad, just different.
Yeah, and I guess it's a more less familiar identity if we're talking about roles of identities and things.
Yeah, for sure. Especially like for me am I a student? Am I a PhD candidate? Like, what am I? I think because I work full time and study part time as well, I do a lot of like transitioning into being a student and then into being an employed person. And that is quite confusing at times.
Yeah, multiple entities, multiple identities and all that sort of thing.
Yep.
And, there's a PhD thesis in itself, really.
It is.
So what were you actually presenting specifically? Do you want to talk about that or
sure.
Is it all still a bit raw?
No, it's good. So I was presenting a short paper, which is part of my findings from my first research question. So this was specifically looking at affordances and mechanics of digital escape rooms. And it comes out of my broader PhD interest, which is looking at whether or not escape rooms, digital escape rooms specifically, can be useful for education, mm-hmm. how we might use things like mechanics to engage people in the classroom. So it's very much design based, and it's like I just sort of said in the session, which is something I've realized fairly recently, I'm really into taking things apart to figure out how they work and then putting them back together. And I think I do that as a job, and I now do that in my PhD with a slightly different context. And I just have to be careful that the spring that's always left over goes back in the right place.
Yeah. The good metaphor. I like that. So
thanks.
Basically, your whole, not only your PhD about escape rooms, you're approaching the whole methodology, process, writing up and everything as itself an escape room. It's
exactly
like, how do I puzzle this out and put all the bits together to get out of doing this goddamn PhD?
Exactly that, yeah. And I'm fortunate enough that I've got a specialist mentor who helps me to think through some of the way that I approach my work. And one of the things we've come up with recently, which is quite funny, I struggle quite a bit with the messiness of research. So when you have loads of different ideas all over the place and loads of different writing, like I do, I have many tabs open all the time. The thing that makes me feel comfortable and settled and secure is having things contained. So we've come up with this idea that I need a laundry basket to put all of my bits in so that I know where everything is. So if you look at my OneDrive for my PhD, you'll just find a document that has a table, and in that table is all of the different bits of documents I'm working on, so that I feel a bit in control of that and I don't focus on the messiness and feeling like I need to tidy it up.
Oh, that's a really good idea. Yeah, because odd little bits of writing and then gradually, hopefully, them all coalescing.
Yeah,
it's not a bad way to write something ultimately, because your ideas aren't necessarily going to form in the sequence in which you need to write them up, really.
Mine definitely don't.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that I found that really, really helpful to have that idea of being able to control some bits and know that some bits won't be controlled. And it also lets me then be a bit more flexible. So,
yeah, it's what Andrew Middleton calls a liberating structure.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And he says I came up with that term, and I'm pretty sure he came up with that term. But between us, it's the whole idea that you put enough in place and then you can spin off from that. But at least you've got the overall trajectory or the overall. What I did on mine was write out all the chapter headings and then write a little bit of that chapter, write a little bit of that chapter. And then I could see it gradually emerging as a whole thing.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like, oh, and that bit needs to go there. It was kind of like filling in Sudoku when I'd finally, just get that into place. But there's another metaphor. You don't need too many metaphors because that just make it more messy again. So what have you got out of the conference? Have you got anything out of it? What's your main takeaways? What have you enjoyed most?
I think it's always nice connecting with people that have very different perspectives but have a shared interest. Mm. So I think that's something that I enjoy about conferences, and it's a really great group of people here. People have been really generous with their engagement and with their feedback. So as much as I feel like a certain way about my session because I am not very confident about my research and presenting it, the way that people were in the session I think demonstrates how great a group of people they are. Because they gave me lots of ideas. We had some really good conversations. They were excited on my behalf about my research, which honestly is probably the biggest compliment I could have. I'm I'm always grateful to that. And also because I have colleagues here from Durham, as well as like people here from Northumbria that I come into contact with, because both my supervisors are here. It's actually really nice to have like my people together.
Oh, so, it's like having the in-laws and your parents at the same and them getting on.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's nice. I think especially with some colleagues that work here, we have worked with previously at Durham, but there's some new colleagues as well that I work with here, with my PhD, like my second supervisor. And it's really, really nice when I get to introduce them to people I work with that are like cool people, and like just see them get along and, you know, create their own relationship. That's kind of fun.
Oh, that's cool. And that helps, I suppose, a lot with the whole, this is who I am as a PhD student as well. It's sort of people affirming the validity of that identity to some extent. Sorry, I'm getting back into therapy mode.
Free therapy is always good.
Yeah, okay. Right then. Well, I didn't say it was free.
Oh, okay.
So, okay, that's brilliant. So what are you going to take away most then from the conference? Something to take back to either your PhD or to your life as a senior learning designer?
So my key takeaway from the conference, I think, is just to try and remember to, I guess, look away from work and from the PhD and be curious. I think it can be quite often the case that you get very caught up in like the routine of life and all the different things that are happening in work and lots of different competing deadlines. And I certainly am experiencing that with my PhD, where it just feels like there is not enough time for anything. And actually, it's really important sometimes to just take a break from that, whatever that looks like, and remind yourself why you're doing it. And I think things like this and interacting with colleagues who are teaching different types of students and have different lived experiences, like, it really just reminds me of, well, actually, in the bigger picture, that is why you're doing it.
Yeah, I think that's because this has been like the summer without conferences for me because of, you know, different things, well, bigger HE issues.
Yeah.
That's what's been missing a bit. And this is why this is so great, is because, well, I get to do it for free because I'm the support team with the podcasting. But it's been really good for that, because this is the first opportunity to do that this year, really. So, yeah, that's been really good. Yeah, just having that liminal space, although I've heard the word liminal gets overused, but I think it's appropriate for this.
It is appropriate.
It's out from anywhere else, really. Yeah.
I think, that and sort of giving yourself permission to be present and forget about the other bits for a while. Like, even if I've been to conferences before, I've very rarely like put an out of office on. I've tried to work as well, and I've been very intentional this time about, no, I'm going as a student. I need to experience as much of it as I can, as I feel comfortable to do, in that headspace, so that I can actually take it in. And I found that to be really helpful to me. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
Space to think, but also after a difficult year, space to connect with other people in other institutions who are also going through difficult times, and just remembering that, you know, behind all of this are people trying to do great things.
Yeah, best they can.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Thanks for sure. Yes, so I have three leading academics from the University of Bamford. Or is it Bamford University? Or does it matter?
100% the University of Bamford.
Okay, right. And so...
A modern traditional university.
Yeah.
The most modern traditional university.
Resist.
You're not a university, you're better.
That's very true. And in order to contextualise that... a university is so bound by its structure.
Mm-hmm.
Bamford is not bound by its structure.
I haven't noticed any structure whatsoever.
No, Bamford is bound by its vibe.
Yeah.
Because we do lean into the sort of ideas of AI in terms of allowing you to code by vibe, we also allow you to learn by vibe.
Okay.
So it's learning.
Vibe learning. You just put enough people in the room and
the vibe happens.
The vibe happens.
It does happen. You see people just walking around the campus learning.
Yeah. I'm feeling the vibe now, in fact. Yeah. In fact, I might even have to take my shirt off.
So
you're very lucky we don't have a HR department.
Yeah, that the vibes were off.
The vibes are certainly off now. So should we go around the room and you can introduce yourselves and what your role is at Banford?
Sure. I am Professor Peter Bryant. I am the chair of the Dystopian Higher Education Futures Department.
Right, and you said earlier in your presentation that there's some tautology involved in that description.
There was definitely some tautology involved in that, but I'll allow you, the listener, to identify what part of that
is tautological.
Is tautological and what part of that is aspirational.
Okay, and Donna, do you want to introduce yourself?
So Donna Longclo, I am the chair of the Department of Online Practice... Philosophy and praxis.
I think we got praxis in there twice, did we? I don't know.
No, practice.
Practice and praxis.
Is, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Don't
sorry,
confuse
I misheard. No, I did. No. I did
and it's
know
very
this.
Important. And yeah. the M dashes in between
those
all of those
are
really,
really important.
Important. It's
yeah,
a really
absolutely.
Important part of the yeah. philosophy
sure.
Of the field.
Yeah. Yeah,
Peter and
absolutely.
I don't have M dashes. We are still trying to work out how to say the M dash pause.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, just a pause, I think, and yeah. then, yeah.
Is it not pause?
A long pause.
Long
one
pause,
of them is a pause
as opposed to an
pause.
M dash.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
yeah.
But you have three M dashes in your second iteration of that, so
yes.
that's an extra long pause.
Yes.
And Laurie.
Yeah, so I'm Professor Laurie Phipps, and I am the Chair of Resistance Leadership.
Now, I wanted to dig into that a little bit, which is, what are you resisting?
What have you got?
Oh, no, it's, I thought
I should have foreseen
there was
that.
There was a simpler answer. What are you resisting? Yeah. Leadership.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, okay.
We are resisting leadership.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. yeah. Sure. So, how has the conference gone for you so far? Have you established anything? Are you feeling that you've explored any of the particular themes?
This is the first time that Banford has come visibly as Banford. We've obviously been attending conferences, as you do, representing yourself and your area of disciplinary expertise.
Yeah.
But this is the first time Banford has come as an identity to a conference. And I think our quite extensive sponsorship of the conference mm-hmm. that we've been able to enact. So we'd like to, everyone should be thanking us for the extra free drink they got yesterday.
Yes.
Courtesy of the University of Banford.
And the stickers.
And the stickers as well.
And the postcards.
And the
yeah.
But I think for us, it's gone really, really well. I think it's launched us into our role, we believe, as thought leaders
sure.
in higher education.
And thinkfluencers.
Thinkfluencers.
You need to say this as you say thought leader as well, I think.
Another one I've picked up today, which I think I like the idea, is that we are influencers.
Yes.
yeah. And to
yes.
call back to it, and curators of a vibe. I think that
yeah.
that's part of our responsibility.
Yeah.
As educators and professors and leaders.
If educators aren't curating vibes now, they're not really doing their job.
Exactly.
They're
right.
Viburators. No.
Viburators is yeah. something you should be looking at.
Yeah, and again, our lack of an HR department makes that possible.
Yeah.
And do you think the vibe has synced with, of your vibe, the Banford vibe, the professorium vibe, has synced with the vibe of the conference? Do you think there's actually, there's been a mutuality with that vibe?
We at the conference now, we've been in lunch and we could basically have taken so many applications to work for Banford.
Yeah.
Everybody is coming to us and saying, when do I get to, not when do I get to work for Banford?
I noticed you overlooked my application last week.
Once again, lack of HR department.
Yeah. That's not on us.
No, on anyone.
No,
fair enough. Yeah. So where are you moving the whole Banford thing through to? What's the goal? What's the next step for Banford U?
We've got a few irons in the fire. Some of the conversations we've been having are around the content space.
Mm.
So there's an awful lot of content out there to be generated and to be consumed and to be disseminated. Traditionally, as we know from the most modern traditional part of our heritage, that would be the library.
Yeah.
But of course, being unbound as we are by structures, I think that there's the vibe of that still has yet to emerge. We're still sort of thinking around it, massaging it. There are a lot of synergies to explore that we just haven't really gotten.
I mean, books are
resist.
I mean, books are intrinsically bound, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so,
yeah,
therefore,
and that, again, that's just not our vibe. I think if we would hate to bind the knowledge. We would hate to bind our students or our faculty to any of those sorts of restrictions.
And also noting that, you know, we have tried to build our knowledge into the capability to interact with where knowledge is now residing. And knowledge is now residing in AI.
Right.
So, you know, whilst we have our agentic teaching bot, Professorium, world-leading, we also have potentially an agentic library bot that actually does all that work. So at the moment, our Department of AI Exceptionalism is looking into that. They are amazing thinking about how they can replace academic work with bots.
But that really becomes the responsibility of the Department of Doing.
Well, the Department of Doing, I think, are the ones who are going to make it manifest, yeah. But certainly the Department of AI Exceptionalism is spending a lot of their time thinking about how you can have a digital student taught by a digital teacher who attends a digital graduation and then goes and works as a digital employee in a digital organisation.
And all of that strategy that we've just been talking about is overseen by our Department of Wealth Creation.
Elusive wealth creation.
So you've got the Department of Elusive Wealth Creation, you've got the Department of Doing.
Yeah.
Where are the academics in this? Are they in the Department of Thinking? Are they on the street?
They're everywhere. Academics are everywhere.
Okay.
So again, unbound.
Sure. Yeah.
You find them in the quad, you find them in the classrooms.
You find them on a park bench.
Yeah. Potentially,
anywhere.
Yeah.
Under a bush.
One of the key things that we're really keen here is to leverage our academic capability.
Leveraging is important.
Yeah, leveraging is really important. And whilst we do have four faculties, and academics are spread across those faculties, they're doing a lot of work at the moment in our adaptive intelligence micro certifications that we've launched about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. So they're delivering and designing those. But what we really want them to do is go out and be management consultants, because that's the future of higher education.
Right.
Working closely with industry, delivering industry-engaged advice and industry-engaged content, and having our academic staff working, providing what we would often refer to as cut-price management consultancy.
But all under the banner of Banford, because in their contracts they do consultancy for us.
Yes. This is all under the auspices of our insourced consultancy wing, which is Banford Enterprises.
Yes.
Right.
Wholly owned by the senior management team.
Yes.
Okay.
And run out of the business school.
Right. And that's probably in very fancy buildings by a river somewhere next to a fancy hotel.
That's classified.
Okay, fair enough. Right. And what's the badges thing? The Go Badgers? Is that the logo?
That's in direct opposition to the other university in Bamford. Bamford has always been closely associated with Badgers. But the other university in Bamford, they have a different mascot that we really don't want to talk about. Bertie is there, and Bertie will remain there in opposition to that.
And badging is important, I think, for any kind of enterprise. Yeah,
it is indeed. But, of course, you know, all universities need something that they can draw the student population together around, bring them into a common world. And Bertie represents the values of our institution. Mm. He's very black and white in the way he thinks.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. He burrows his head into the earth when necessary and lets the crisis ride over him.
He goes out a lot at night.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think Bertie is actually a symbol of the kind of values and ethics that we hold very dear at the University of Banford.
He's also cute as hell.
Yeah.
I can tell you what, he sells a truckload
of merch.
Or Bertie plush.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The merch store is...
Through the roof.
Yeah, the merch store is opening soon.
You can get your Bertie merchandise at unibanford.com.
So what will you be taking back from the conference? What have you kind of acquired through your interactions here? Is there synergies that you've observed that you'll be able to use to implement further changes at Banford?
I found a pen that I've got.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a good lunch.
Yeah, my lunch was great.
Yeah, it was good.
Nice.
I think one thing we've identified by being at the conference is there's just a real demand for the kinds of conversations that, again, the unbound approach that Banford just brings to the world of education, and really to the world generally. People are crying out for the kind of brave conversations that we're willing to have about the nature of everything.
Resist.
Right, so now we step behind the curtain, outside the curtain, away from the kayfabe.
Beyond the curtain.
Beyond the curtain. Beneath the
beyond.
Curtain. Beyond. Oh, I know Laurie's already... he told me that Donna used to be WWE, and I believed him for a split second. Oh, this has been a long day. That's my only excuse. So I'm actually now going to talk to the real Peter, Donna, and Laurie, as real as they get, I guess, which isn't necessarily that real. So, Peter, tell us who you are and what you're doing here and what the Bamford thing is all about.
Okay, so
from your perspective.
I'm Peter Bryant. I'm a professor of business education at the University of Sydney Business School, and I'm also a visiting professor at King's Business School in London. I'm here to try and articulate the vision of the methodology behind a scenario-led intervention workshop that we've been running for about 2.5 years now. And part of the reason this conference is really important for us was you can run a workshop and it works, and you kind of can reflect on it and you understand why it works.
Mm-hmm.
What we wanted to do is actually try and understand what was the methodology that was driving that, to give it a rigor and a sense of reliability, that it wasn't just three people in the room making things up, and that there was something behind it that generated outcomes with meaning and outcomes with purpose. So for us, this conference was the opportunity to write that as a paper,
right?
To put it together, to put a methodology behind it, to think about why we're interested in something that's inductive, why we're interested in something that's immersive, why we're interested in something that generates dialogues, not just amongst ourselves, but amongst the people we bring into the workshop, why we're interested in pushing and challenging theory and practice, not to stretch it or to deny or agree with it, but to actually bend it, shape it, remix it and repurpose it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that, we were able to do that. But what's been fascinating has been to actually do that in close proximity to running it. And that's been a real difference to us. We've had those conversations around theory and methodology. We've ran the workshops, but to actually do them as we did yesterday, back to back effectively, actually gave both quite a rich sense of understanding of what we were doing.
And it's given us an opportunity for reflection.
So, Donna, do you want to introduce yourself? And then maybe also tell us a little bit about what those two workshops were then, what the content of them was.
So I'm Donna Longclough. I am an anthropologist and a consultant. I've been working in the sector for a while. I've been working with these two for a very long time.
My commiserations.
I will say that I think the fact that we come from different disciplinary backgrounds is part of the strength of the workshop and the scholarship that we then bring to the workshop, but then get to extend out from the process. So I'm, as an anthropologist, reflection is a major part of our disciplinary approach to studying anything. And so I think the Bamford, for me personally, the point of Bamford has been to try to contribute spaces for people to process the trauma
mm-hmm.
of the recent and not so recent history of education and academia. We've had a rough go of it even before 2020, and then it really got going with the pandemic emergency. And I think we personally needed, and we've said this in the paper and in the workshop, we personally needed ways to stay connected as friends and colleagues, but also to process what is happening and to give people a way through it that isn't just, well, good luck with that, but maybe trying to give people some tools so that they can reclaim some agency away from forces that seem determined to strip agency from most of us.
And that playfulness then and the silliness of Bamford, it sort of immediately gives people its permission to be as cynical or as positive or as whatever they like. With you've got the element of humor, which always takes the edge off, and then the world building just I guess creates some sort of verisimilitude for all of the kinds of wacky stuff you asked us to do in the workshops.
It gives them a way. It gives you a way in, right? You're like, oh, I have this postcard, or I have this sticker, or I see that part of the video, and it triggers a desire to participate in a lot of people by that isn't just, oh, I'm in a room and I'm going to do a workshop now.
Yeah. So, Laurie, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself then and about what specifically did you do yesterday in the workshop and what was different about today's workshop? Do you want to just run us through that? But first of all, yeah, who are you?
So I'm Professor Laurie Phipps. I've got a chair in digital leadership at the University of Chester, and I also work for JISC. The workshops, for me, are about how we engage and understand crises.
Okay.
And I think some of this emerged from the pandemic. During the pandemic, I did work. Helen O'Sullivan at Chester, when she was at a different university, she got me looking at how people were experiencing the pandemic, the crisis. And one of the things that we noticed were vulnerable groups of people were actually doing better during a crisis than they were during normal university timings. Mm-hmm. They actually, their achievements went up. And I was really interested in that. How are they experiencing a crisis and doing well? And so what we've done with Banford and what we did in the workshop yesterday was to sort of put people in situations where they can experience a crisis of policy. So we had a vice chancellor yesterday who came in and said, this is the new policy, effectively. That policy is analog. Enough of the digital nonsense. Write me a strategy that is all about being analog. And we put people through that, and they have to think about how they do their practice. And in a room full of learning technologists and learning designers, you get a whole load of people, you know, resist. Mm. You know, a whole load of people do not like that. So then we sort of get them doing that. Then we actually, in the workshop yesterday, we got them to then think about, well, what happens if you come in and your new vice chancellor says, we are going to be the most educationally technology focused university in the sector. And they experience that and they say, okay, well, we were over here and now we're going to have a blank sheet of paper and completely do everything and redesign what we're going to do from the bottom up. Yesterday, we did that.
Like, it was three blank sheets of paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
The difference to today's workshop was that it was actually a sheet of paper that you added to for the second one, and then you added to for the third.
Well, in theory, yeah. We started again each time because it was just, quite a
big answer, the purpose of today is we actually got people to react. So today we got you to look at the opportunities.
Yeah.
So before we would get you to look at threats and opportunities. Mm. Today we got you to look at opportunities and say, okay, the vice chancellor's come in. I don't like this new policy.
Yeah.
But there's a threat opportunity paradox. Yeah. Somebody's threat is also somebody else's opportunity.
That's what. Yeah.
So what are the opportunities? Don't think about the threats. What are the opportunities? I don't like it, but there's opportunity here. What are they? Mm-hmm. And that's what we got you to focus on today.
And then if those opportunities were so good for the university and the university pivoted direction, as we know that it does every 5 years or every 3 years, depending on the strategic planning cycle, how do you keep those opportunities going?
Yeah.
Because the students that came there for those opportunities, the academics and researchers who joined the institution for those opportunities, 3 years is a very short time of cycle.
Yeah.
And that whiplash means that you don't get the benefit of someone who's been there 5, 7, 9 years and get the institutional knowledge out of it. You don't get someone who does their 3-year degree and willing to come back and do a postgraduate or do a micro cert or do a PhD.
If there's a good pedagogy opportunity or a good research opportunity that stems out of a policy that a vice chancellor has implemented, a vice chancellor coming in and then shifting policy shouldn't make those opportunities no longer opportunities.
Yeah.
So how do you actually reframe those opportunities? And that's what we're trying to get people to focus on today.
Well, and I think a key difference between what we did yesterday and what we did today, because we learned from what we did yesterday and decided that we wanted to change things up a bit, is that the final exercise was asking people to think about how to operationalize the values that had emerged from the first two exercises. And one of the things that I like to do in workshop delivery is to give people an opportunity to walk away with something concrete.
Yeah.
So something that, oh, okay, given this, this is what it would look like if I did a thing, if I wrote a policy, if I put a group of things together. So I think while I think both of them were successful, I think we were more specific the second time around in directing people through a sequence that built one on top of the other instead of doing three kind of loosely connected exercises that I do think were effective in terms of reflecting, but maybe a little less emphatic on practical, concrete takeaways from the workshop.
And that's our method, too.
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday we ran a workshop. We then did a paper about the methodology. We then went away and talked about the workshop. We sat down and we said, what did we learn about how people felt? How did people react? And that's the co-generative dialogue, is we three sitting down and saying, what did we learn from the people in the room? We then applied what we had learned and pivoted our workshop and changed what we did today. So that's our co-generative dialogue.
Oh, and that's was that what you were heading off to do when you found me trying to find my car?
Yes.
Did you find the car?
Yes. It was about 5 minutes later. There's one direction I'd not tried, and there it was. Yeah, senior moment, I'm afraid. So talking about taking away concrete things, what concrete thing are you taking away from this conference then?
For me, it's about the importance of embedding a rigorous approach to research in digital education. One of the things that any educational research, pedagogical research, evaluative research, scholarship for teaching and learning, whatever you want to call it, one of the struggles it has in any institution is the belief of its efficacy as a research methodology or research approach, its efficacy as influencing practice, and its influence as being its efficacy as being something that is equally as serious as the disciplinary research done by other parts of the institution.
Yeah.
And we need conferences like this to build a momentum of practice that improves people's research. There are some ECRs here. There are some learning designers and ed techs who have never researched before, doing things that are using research methodologies, research language, putting it into a conference and then getting the feedback about that. And I talked to a few last night at dinner, encouraging them to say, well, you got that. Now write it up as a conference paper.
Yeah.
Now write it up as a journal article, because it is through those, whatever what we think about them, it is through those that the reputation and importance of the research we do in digital education becomes manifest.
Cool.
So this morning we came in before the conference started, and I was standing at the breakfast bar, and they had those bagels with the vegetarian sausages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got one of those in my bag.
Oh, that's smart. I just
that's what I'm taking away.
Okay.
Resist.
I would like to say that I will take away the reminder to myself of the importance of connecting with people and talking to them about what you're doing and why. I think that we don't have enough of those opportunities. I think that conferences provide us the spaces between the everyday and the exceptional. I think that normalizing regular opportunities to think with each other, because I think the systems that we're surrounded in are increasingly encouraging us to think in isolation. And I think that part of what we're trying to do with Banford is suggest that thinking together is one of the ways out of that isolation.
And I think in seriousness, one of the things that this conference has highlighted for me is there is some diversity in the room at this conference. We've got a vice president for student engagement here, and we've got learning designers, we've got lecturers, and we've got senior researchers. There's a whole group of people here that don't normally operate together on a day-to-day basis. And for me, when we were then looking at Bamford, it's trying to thread the needle on making it relevant to everybody and making our workshops inclusive. And I hope we did that with the exercises, that there was something for everybody. But it also made me realize the importance of when you're designing. How often do we go to a conference with one thing that we do and we never look at it again?
Yeah.
Bamford is something that we have done and will continue to do. And every time we do it, there will be something different. But I also hope that every time we do it, we'll be able to engage different people to learn different things.
And each time, I guess, the world building is that much more built because you've spent that much more time on it. More people have come into that process.
We took ideas today from somebody that decided that we needed, and there will now be something new coming to Bamford in the near future.
Oh, nice. Okay.
But I think it's cool. Also, as a participant at a conference, you know, you get that wonderful conference glow, that sense that, oh, I've had such a great time at the conference, and then you go back to your work.
Yeah.
And that kind of glow gets scrubbed off. What the way we've tried to create the world, you can always dip back into the world of Bamford. Like the website isn't the thing that we talked about today. It wasn't the thing that drove the workshops. But you can always just go back into that and go, what are they up to now? What's going on in their world?
It's possible there might be something new coming in terms of engagement post-conference. You know, maybe, I don't know, there might be the Bamford Discord.
Potentially.
Well, and if you need a podcast, you know where to come.
We're always needing content.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we're tired of the Notebook LM podcast. They just don't do it as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a relief because I've listened to a couple of them and thinking, oh, it's better than what I do. Maybe. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Okay, thanks for both of the chats, and yeah, and that's, oh god, I need a better ending than that, don't I? So yeah, hopefully hear from more from Bamford in the future. Oh my god, that's only cheesy. I'm gonna, anyway, we'll leave you there. We have Chris now. Chris, do you want to tell us a bit about yourself, where you're from, what you do?
Hello everyone, my name is Chris.
Chris,
I'm Balafoutis.
Aha.
Purely Greek. I'm from Greece. I am a PhD student, well, former PhD student. I just completed my PhD in criminology at City University.
Oh, hang on. I have an applause thing. Where is it? Oh, my God. Oh, here we go. Oh, you can't hear that. Of course you can't, because you haven't got the headphones on. Anyway, it was a sound effect of applause.
Wonderful. Thank you very, very much.
You'll have to listen to it back on the recording.
And after I completed my PhD, I did my master's in academic practice, which was part of the City University program in order to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So today I presented my paper regarding how technology-enhanced learning can facilitate the learning of quantitative methods in social sciences.
Okay.
As social sciences students tend to deassociate from quantitative methods, presenting statistics anxiety, which I think it's a common thing for most students that are not studying STEM subjects. So, yes, I mean, it's quite usual for students not liking quantitative methods, and I would just explore how technology-enhanced learning can actually facilitate their learning.
Oh, and because it's kind of like crossing boundaries, really. You're sort of I started off in astrophysics and then moved to media studies as disciplines to study. And there's quite an epistemical. Aha, okay. Sorry, it's a Greek word in basis. So it's epistemological basis for this a kind of crossing the boundary between two epistemologies, isn't it?
Exactly.
And I guess that's where the anxiety comes from. So what did you find from what were you presenting in your presentation then? What specifics are there about?
The main focus was how using SPSS in classroom and applying real-world examples can help overcoming statistics anxiety. One of the main findings was exactly that most students that ended up studying sociology, anthropology, in general social sciences, came from a theoretical background in school.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Greece, we have three different routes. One is called theoretical, the second one is called maths, and the third one is called technological. So in order to study in social sciences, you would have to go through the theoretical route, which doesn't have any maths at all.
Right.
So then you admit to a sociology program, and suddenly you have to do statistics, which you have not done for many, many years, or at all during school years. So that was one of the main findings, students found that they're anxious about statistics because they had no previous experience. And also they had an issue with the language because not only they were not able to understand the respective terminology in English, they didn't have enough experience to understand it in their native language. So Overall, it was a very hard experience for them. And eventually, technology-enhanced learning helped quite a lot of them, as it has a cooperative component that fosters pedagogical socialization. In essence, these sessions are following a game-like approach.
Okay.
Where students are being divided into teams and they have to complete a specific task without having the feeling that they're being assessed by their tutor. So they can ask questions, mm-hmm. they are not afraid to make mistakes, ultimately enhancing their confidence and eventually not only changing their perception towards statistic methods, but actually helping them learn how to use quantitative methods in social sciences.
And what it all means, it's like, yeah. I mean, that's for me, that's the issue is, and I guess that's a common experience with people from a qualitative side when they're looking at stats, is it doesn't stick, or you only need one bit of the terminology. What's twin tail again? Or whatever. And then if that doesn't stick, then all of the rest of it all just falls apart anyway. So I'm guessing having that, being able to tap into just that bit of information you need at that one point, and then rehearsing that over and over again, that's how they, is that what you found that people
Yes,
really
one of the main one of the main components, one of the main opinions students had that was that they need constant practice with quantitative methods because as you said, like after a while we will just forget because it's not that the terminology is quite specific and there is a load of it. You have to understand the very specifics of how these relationships work in statistical terms.
Yeah.
And if you do not grasp that into actual real world examples, you're never going to remember.
Yeah.
The most common example I can refer to people who are not familiar with statistics is recent discussions about various statistics. For example, now on immigration, we're discussing like these many immigrants are in, these many immigrants are out. And then people are commenting and they're saying, yeah, you have forgotten to do that per capita. Yeah. So once you understand what per capita means, for example, you're never going to forget it. But if you do not use it enough, at some point you will eventually end up assessing statistics the same way you did before you learn about what per capita means. So systemic practice with statistics is what makes them to actually stick in your head, and you can use them furthermore in your studies and professional life, of course.
Cool. And so, sorry, I keep saying cool. Oh, cool. No, it is. I mean, it just finding different ways to help people through that process is, it's must be really helpful and also applicable in so many different situations, because so many people are stuck with that particular thing, really, with, you know, being a qualitative person ordinarily and then having to deal with a bunch of stats. And it is so easy to just go, oh, I'm not a stats person. But at some point we all have to be, don't we, really?
Well, the majority of technology-enhanced learning and quantitative methods is focused on STEM subjects, which are not directly applicable to sociology. So we need like different approaches in order to explain quantitative methods through technology-enhanced learning. But the most important is that it is interactive in a game-like environment, gamification of education, where the most important part is that while you're working on those real-world examples with others, you see the results straight away. So, for example, you're making a map of criminal occurrences in London and you compare two boroughs, and you see that, for example, one borough has more incidents than the other.
Mm.
And then you implement the per capita we were describing before, and you see that the second borough is actually more dangerous because there are like
fewer people
in there compared to the other borough. And suddenly you have a result that translate as an achievement, like winning in a video game.
Mm-hmm.
So since you have the ability to distinguish between these two, automatically you have you're one step forward compared to everybody else that has no idea what per capita means.
Right.
So having that extra achievement in your agenda while doing that is what actually motivates students to get engaged more and gain confidence in using quantitative methods.
Because I can see the gradual progress and it's, yeah, it's bringing an element of competition and all that sort of thing. Oh, excellent. So my final question is, how have you found the conference overall? I mean, was the has it been worthwhile attending?
Yes, of course. And I would suggest colleagues and students to attend the next conferences as they will find it extremely useful, especially given that we're moving towards an era where digitalized education is going to be a main component. So, yes, I think it would be really, really useful for colleagues to actually attend and get a grasp of what the educational technology of the future is going to be shaped like.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Sorry,
I took you away from the keynote. Just no record this little bit, but hopefully there's still time left to pick up something
yes.
Amir's thing.
I'll go and see.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you very, very much.
No problem at all. Okay.